I'm Nurit Ben. This is Life Deconstructed. Intimate, open conversations with inspiring women from all different fields and backgrounds, how they got to where they are, the debates, decisions, and doubts along the way, and what success even means. Her designs are raw, purposely imperfect, and endlessly elegant. Back in 2014, Roche Matani founded Alighieri after a boring one-day wax carving class helped her fall in love with the medium. Less than 5 years later, the business had an annual growth rate of 500% and was sold in big-name stores like Selfridges and Net-a-Porter. As the brand moved into its new London showroom, Roche talked to us about growing up in Zambia, feeling lost, why she hates being put in a box, and how she dove fearlessly into launching a meaningful jewelry brand with no actual jewelry-making experience. Roche Matani, thank you so much for being here and for joining us amid the move from one studio to another. Sounds like a crazy time, but I'm really glad we got to catch up.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to, you know, take some time out to talk and reflect on the journey of how we got here.
Yeah, I'm sure that with such a busy schedule and so deep in it, there's not as much time to kind of step aside and zoom out. So I appreciate you taking the time to do that with me because I'm so interested in your journey and your collections and the inspiration and on, but as usual, I always like to start more at the beginning to really try to understand each woman's own series of decisions or lessons learned and all that stuff that brought you to where you are. So tell me first about some of your life growing up in Zambia. I mean, what brought your family there, first of all?
Yeah, so both my sets of grandparents were born in India and they lived on the border of India and Pakistan. And when the country got partitioned, they kind of lost their homes. And they had a friend who had set up shop in Zambia and he said, you know, come over, like, I'll help you start again. So both my parents' families emigrated and made a life for themselves in a small town called Indola, very, very small town. That was really kind of the story of my family. And I spent my early childhood there until I was about seven/eight before moving to London.
Do you have a lot of memories from that time or is it a little bit of a blur until seven?
No, absolutely. I feel, you know, I have such strong memories and feel very, very connected to Zambia and to Africa and my earliest memories are there. And I have, you know, a myriad of stories of what I would do as a kid because you really had to use your imagination. There wasn't much to do, which I think I found frustrating as a child. But now that I look back, I'm actually feeling quite grateful because I've really learned to, you know, live in my imagination and be resourceful and, you know, create something out of nothing, which is, I think, something that's really kind of carried on with Alighieri.
Yeah. So actually, I guess I imagine in retrospect that that time there where you didn't have, like these days, an iPad or a phone stuck in your face and you had to create your own entertainment actually contributed a lot to your creativity today.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's like the early 90s and everything that you could buy in Zambia had to be imported. So everything was super expensive. So it was a real luxury to, you know, have a new notebook or a set of paints. They were luxuries. It made everything really special. And I remember, you know, making my own notebooks and stitching them together and really like loving that idea of making something from scratch. So let alone iPads and phones, it was really like even one step further back, but quite magical in that way.
I think that's great. I frankly think that's a really good way to grow up, to actually have to use your mind. And I think that's kind of scary now and how to manage kids. I have a 5-month-old now. And
oh, wow, congratulations.
It's my first child. And thank you. And now I'm just thinking about that. I'm like, that is exactly how I would choose for her to grow up. And I don't even know how one does that in today's world, but that's a whole other conversation. Anyway, a little bit of inspiration there that I'll try to take with me forward. But so when you guys went to London, and did you have any kind of expectation or pressure around what you're supposed to do, so to speak? Or did you have your own like self-imposed ideas about what that is?
It's such a good question. And it's, you know, a big question because it was such an upheaval in my life. You know, I dreamt of moving to London and we'd come on holiday in the summers. You know, London to me was a land where there were escalators and like shops and museums.
Yeah, what a culture shock.
Yeah, and it felt, you know, exciting and shiny, and that was amazing. So I think I was excited, but the reality of moving was actually really difficult. You know, my parents are absolutely incredible. They moved to London so that my brother and I could have, you know, a really good education, and they sort of sacrificed everything that they had in order to, you know, put us through private school. And for them, that was, you know, doing the best for their kids. But for us, it was actually quite difficult. As, you know, a 9-year-old, I, you know, was thrown into this really amazing all-girls primary school, this Catholic school in Hampstead. And I just felt very different. I guess I was the only, you know, person of color in my school. And wow. There was also, you know, a socio-demographic difference between, you know, what my friends had and what we had. And yeah. I guess it's also a transitional time as a woman in general. You know, you're 10, you're going on to 11. You don't really know who you are.
And yeah, it's already hard enough.
Yeah, it was really difficult and actually quite horrible. I don't have happy memories of that. But I think, you know, I learned a lot, but I was very lost for sure.
Yeah. I think a lot of times we tend to glamorize in retrospect different periods of life. Mm. Like it could be that period of adolescence or high school. And almost the further you get removed from it, the more it can be, you know, oh, so great to be that young and everything was possible, blah, blah, blah. But actually, it's like a really awful time for a lot of people. And it's really challenging.
That was awful. I would never go back.
Yeah. I actually happen to think about that, about some of the 20s too.
Oh, me too.
But that depends. The whole, you know, what am I going to do with my life? Who am I stuff?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that is basically the story of the brand for me. The whole story of why I started it was to take the glamour away from that idea of, you know, youth and everyone seems to be living their best life. You know, ultimately, nobody knows what the hell they're doing. Everyone feels lost. And I hated the fact that, you know, everyone just was pretending that they had it all together. I'm sure some people did have it together, which is amazing. But I just wanted to be real.
But not all the time, at least.
No, exactly. And
that is Dante, then, being lost and finding your way.
Yeah, it's lost in the dark wood, exactly. And being honest about that and not being afraid of it. Just kind of embracing it as part of the journey.
Yeah, that's a huge thing for me. And I think so important in these conversations too, to hear versus what we can often see. Like if I were to just read about you and say, oh my God, you know, it's just everything fell into place and is aligned. And she just, you know, had an epiphany and it all happened and blah, blah,
not
blah.
At all.
So I want to get a little more into that, but rewind a bit then, because obviously your parents succeeded in their goal in getting you guys a great education. You went to Oxford, studied French and Italian. So obviously literature ended up being a very big part of your work.
Yeah.
But at the time, did you have to deal with the sort of question of practicality of that major? Were you doing it because it was out of a passion, or you thought, okay, this is what I'm going to do when I grow up, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I had no idea, you know, what I wanted to do. So I just followed what I loved, and I loved languages.
Best advice, by the way.
I think so. I mean,
at that age, especially, just study what you love.
Yeah, like if you have the luxury to be able to do it, which, you know, I was really lucky to have that.
Sure.
And I just loved stories. I loved writing. I loved entering into different universes and different cultures. So I guess I saw it as a portal, you know, do something that captures your imagination and that can be your portal to get to the next step, whatever that next step might be.
Yeah, I think that these days when an undergrad, unfortunately, is much less useful than it was in the past in terms of, you know, practical leading to a very specific career, it's so important to just, again, if you can, if you have that luxury, to study something that really interests you, because I think that's the best shot we get at such a unique time in life also to just like explore and try to figure ourselves out.
Yeah.
Which doesn't come that often.
I know. And you don't realize at the time you just have months to read books. Like, I wish I could just read books all day again.
Yeah, I know.
Like going to the library, just spending the whole day in the library.
I know. Well, there's a reason people say youth is wasted on the young. You know? It's pretty damn true. So I know that you did some internships along the way. I saw personally, I studied at NYU, and for me, internships, because I was very much lost also, I mean, had no idea, had so many different parts of myself that I thought could be different paths, but didn't know which one to go on. And internships were a good way to try to test things out, and more often than not, figure out what you don't want to do versus what you do. So what were those for you? What did you learn there?
So, you know, one of the first internships I did was with a jewelry designer in Australia. I always loved traveling. I think I was always trying to run away. And I loved jewelry. So I did a year with an amazing jewelry designer who is French, but she's based out in Melbourne. And it was a great...
Did you move out there for the internship?
I did, yeah. And I'd always loved Australia. I'd always wanted to spend some time living there. So it was the perfect kind of opportunity to do that. And at the same time, I was doing a two-day-a-week internship with the travel brand Mr. and Mrs. Smith in their PR department. So I was just sort of learning every part of the industry. And as you say, figuring out what I liked, what I didn't like, and just saw it as just a way to learn. And I learned so much. And, you know, then I came back to the UK and I did a month at Harper's Bazaar in the fashion closet, which was not glamorous at all.
Yeah. That is definite. That's a myth. That's a big myth.
But I met so many great people, and, you know, it's about that and like making friends and seeing every part of it. And I think it really helped me because when I started Alighieri, I'd sort of seen every aspect of how the industry worked. And it's something that I feel quite strongly about in the company, that everyone should have a global understanding of everyone else's job. And nobody is too big to steam an outfit or pack a box. That's like, we write that on all our job descriptions. You know, we're all doing everything.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, coming from a very different perspective of news and broadcasting, I always say the same thing, especially when I was training correspondents and journalists in various places, is that it just makes such a massive difference. For example, if a producer knows what it's like to be an anchor correspondent, if a correspondent knows what it's like to be a researcher, I mean, there's so many different moving parts, like I'm sure there are for you. And it makes such a difference in each team member if you really get what the other person is doing, or you get what the process is to get there. And especially not being too big to try things.
Yeah.
I started at an internship at the CBS Evening News. And I remember in my early days when I was already staff on weekend news, every time someone else would bring like coffee and donuts, including the executive producer of the whole show.
Oh, I love that.
And then one time the intern was asked to do it and she quit in a huff saying, I absolutely not. I did not come here to bring coffee, and left. And I was like, this is the essence of, you know, entitlement and not getting it in that sense. So I think that's good philosophy to have over there.
I was going
to
say, like, I see the line, right? Because especially in the fashion industry, like historically, interns were not treated very well, or, you know, not paid. So I totally see that, you know, people should stand their ground and obviously be respected and be paid for their time and their work.
Absolutely.
But it can't go too far the other way. Like, everyone is an equal in the room.
Yeah, it has to depend on the overall atmosphere.
Yeah,
absolutely. In retrospect, is there any kind of guiding thing that you think you figured out from those experiences that, you know, maybe now you see more than then?
I think I figured out that I never wanted to do just one thing. I loved the variety. And that's, I think, why I started Alighieri, because, you know, I love jewelry. I love the making process, but I also love the storytelling of it. And I love photography.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love business. I love numbers and I like people. And so I like the cyclical journey of it. So I think the various internships taught me and showed me that my path was really, you know, to have the variety in the role and to have like that kind of holistic perspective over what I would be doing.
That's beautiful also to find something where you can integrate all those things.
I'm very lucky, yeah.
I find it a little scary to just like to say, okay, you have to choose this one thing.
Yeah.
And I'm also a Libra, and I guess I was never into astrology, but the older I get, I'm like, yeah, that actually makes sense.
Yeah. You know,
this desire to balance and integrate so many different things into one, I think that's a really beautiful.
Yeah, because it's all kind of interconnected, isn't it? I think actually what's really interesting is that in our society, we're so used to putting things in boxes.
Like, absolutely.
Oh, this is an arty person. Like, she's really numerical. She's really creative. Or, you know,
yes.
And actually, why can't we just go back to the Renaissance man philosophy? Like, we're all just building every facet of ourselves, and we are multifaceted. And I think that extends to, you know, gender discussions and race discussions. And
absolutely.
I think the main problem is the boxing of people into categories. Like, just be. I hope that doesn't sound too like kumbaya, but like, why can't we all just be who we are?
No, I think it's so important. Especially, I think we're trained to think that way from an early age. I don't know what it's like in London, you'll tell me. In the US, it's definitely, and especially in New York, you know, the first question is always, what do you do?
Mm.
And that means that's like a title. It's a very simple title.
Mm.
And like you say, it's either a creative thing. It's, you know, it can be, I'm an artist, or I'm a business person, or I'm a, you know, the answer to that question isn't normally complex. It doesn't really allow for it. So I think we kind of subconsciously from an early age, it's like, what do you do? Like,
yeah,
you know, this is what I do. This is my identity. This is the job.
I often think about that, because whenever I meet someone new, I'm always curious about what they do, because I want to know more about them.
Yeah.
But I agree. I appreciate that sometimes that question can seem just unfair because not everyone is defined by what they do or loves what they do. And I always wonder, like, what is an alternative question that you could ask as an opener to someone to really get to know them?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I agree, because what someone chooses to do with their life, at least in that moment, is so interesting and says so much about, you know, who they are. And it's kind of like the easiest conversation opener. But yeah, that's food for thought. I think I'm going to come back to that at some point in this season.
But that's, you know, what I love about jewelry is actually, I think it's such a great way to get to know people, because whenever I've said to someone, I love your necklace, they will tell me where that necklace is from, the story behind it, probably something to do with their grandparents.
And yeah, the story.
Like that, I've gotten to know them in a really intimate way very quickly. And that's what I love about it. Yeah. I sort of see these talismans as a kind of the way to unlock people's stories.
Is that also linked to the way you refer to them as heirlooms?
Yeah, I think I, you know, write a story about each piece and I imbue it with my story, but then I hope the person that wears it carries it forward and imbues them with their own stories and adventures before passing them on to the next generation, whether that be a friend, a child, a godchild. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I very much see jewelry that way myself. I told you before we started that I've had a healthy to unhealthy jewelry obsession my entire life. And for me, that's also part of what I love so much about it, is that each thing has a meaning, whether it's something you picked up in a travel along the way, or like you said, something from a grandparent, something that symbolizes a point in your life or a particular experience. So I love that that's kind of the starting point for the brand. So let's talk about that. Okay, so Alighieri 2014, you start. And for people who might be listening and not yet familiar with it, I find what's so beautiful is that you have this elusive combination, at least this is just a outside viewer's perspective, of this rough around the edges, very raw aesthetic, this imperfection, like you say, and then somehow also super polished and elegant all in one.
Thank you.
So you said jewelry is something that you had in mind, but doing a jewelry line, starting a business around it, is that something that ever struck you as, okay, that's it for me?
It's really interesting. I wish I had a nutshell answer. I mean, I always loved jewelry because I loved, as you did, like that everything had a meaning, everything had a story. And when I was, you know, going back to my childhood, I would collect stones, and my great aunt had this mound of rocks in her garden. And whenever we used to go there, I used to run to that mound of rocks. It was like my special treat. She'd give me a bag and I would dig for treasure. And I found, you know, what I know now as an adult was, you know, pyrite and amethyst. But to me, I thought they were like pure gold and like meteorites. And I would save them and like make an inventory of them and hide them every evening so that nobody would find them, so they didn't get stolen. So looking back on it, I think I always had that without realizing that I had that. And when I graduated, I always loved collecting jewelry from markets and elevating things that other people didn't think were special because they weren't precious.
Yeah, giving them new life.
Yeah, and reinventing them. And I just started like that. You know, I started making a couple of pieces. I couldn't stop reading Dante. And I was like, I'm going to start making one piece for each one of his poems as a therapy, because, you know, I felt quite lost. I didn't know what I was doing with my life. I was super heartbroken at the time.
How did you learn how to even make it? You started out in wax. Is that right?
Yeah. So I did a 1-day wax carving course and actually hated it because it was very regimented and my brain doesn't work like that. So I left that course. I went to buy some wax and just started playing and made a few things and took them to a caster in Hatton Garden who had now become, you know, like my family. We still use them. And they just taught me along the way. And it was a lot of trial and error. And the mistakes that happened were, you know, some of my favorite parts of it. And it just kind of took on a life of its own. I think once I started doing it, writing the stories and photographing the pieces, at that point something just clicked where I was like, this is my language. I feel like I have a language for the first time that makes me feel at ease, that I don't have to pretend to be anything that I'm not, and that people resonated with it. So yeah, it felt like a great relief actually in my life.
Yeah, I can imagine, to find a place where you can bring together all those things. Mm. What was it about wax that connected to you about that medium of creation?
I love how tactile it is. I love the kind of the textures that you can create. It feels quite spiritual. You know, I sit in front of a Roman candle and that heat and the way the wax can change with heat, I just find incredible. I've always loved fire, even as a small kid. It feels, you know, really rudimentary and malleable, and it feels like anything's possible. Mm-hmm. And it's the textures for me. I feel like creating these textures that mean something different. I don't know how to explain. It's very emotional as a material.
And it allows for happy mistakes, like you say, versus designing something on a computer and having it very precise.
Yeah, exactly. It celebrates the process, and the process is part of, you know, I never know what the piece is going to turn out to be. And I love that because it's no pressure. I think it represents freedom for me, actually.
That's great. That's beautiful. So when you're starting out and you feel that connection with the medium and making these pieces, showing them to colleagues, but still no proper, so to speak, training in jewelry making or in business classes or whatever it is, did you have any trepidation, any fear around launching into it and saying, okay, I'm going to do this for real? Or was it all so gradual?
Weirdly, no. Weirdly, I never felt scared about it because I just felt it felt right.
Yeah.
Both my parents were really supportive, but I think my mum was afraid for me. She was like, oh God, like, you know, you're taking the difficult path. But no, weirdly, I just had this kind of conviction with it from the very beginning. I never felt afraid of it because it just felt right.
So let's talk a little bit of those first steps and how you actually go from that one day wax course to creating this beautiful brand. What were, I mean, the first steps when you saw that, you know, you got this feedback from people, obviously, that they loved it and you saw that this was the right thing for you. How do you begin in actually growing it and making it what you wished?
So I had two different types of rings that I first made. One was this kind of crustacean that was kind of looked like it had just emerged from the sea, and it was really battered and unpolished. And then I had a crab claw, really inspired by the fifth canto of the Inferno. It's a story about two lovers trapped in this infernal storm and this idea of stasis. You're moving, but you're not actually progressing. And I kind of was relating that to the way a crustacean moves. Mm-hmm. And people in the office liked it. So I took all my money and I made 20 of each and wiped out my bank account.
Wow.
And started selling them at the pub and, you know, said, if anyone wants one, they had £50 each. And I had none left by the end of the evening. And that was amazing. And then all my friends were just super supportive and everyone just tried to connect me with anyone that they knew. It was definitely difficult the first 2 years. I was working as an au pair at the same time, putting, you know, everything I earned back into the brand. Lots of closed doors, lots of trying, and people, you know, especially with stores saying, you know, no, sorry, not for us. And so, yeah, a lot of rejection in the beginning, and it was difficult, but little by little it picked up. And
I just want to stop you there for a second. At what point did you bring in other people? You know, how long were you doing it all on your own?
A long time. So 2 years in, I was still on my own. And then I brought in an assistant to help me just get the orders out whilst I was doing my day job as orders started to pick up. And that was very kind of ad hoc freelance.
When were you actually creating all this time, especially while working?
I would always do it at nighttime. Just, you know, it's like my kind of
meditation
moment to myself. Yeah, yeah, very much so. And it was only, you know, year four that I made my first hire as a head of production.
Wow.
So it was a long time by myself, which was tough, but then I also learned how to do everything. So
yeah, sure.
Yeah, so kind of it was 4 years in that I hired a head of production and someone to help me on press. Until then, everything was just me. But, you know, I think that's how it grew because everything was super personal.
Yeah. And you could probably adapt pretty quickly when it's just you and you don't have to get a team together around it.
Yeah.
Well, that's incredible, though, because within that same time frame, if I'm not mistaken, you grew, I mean, exponentially, exponentially, exponentially.
Yeah.
So especially with getting sold places, you were talking about the closed doors. I mean, now you're sold in boutiques around the world. There's big name stores like Selfridges and Net-a-Porter. How did you figure out, you know, how to approach those people, what you even need in order to, you know, show up to Net-a-Porter and say, hey, you should carry this line?
It's so funny. I'd been emailing them every season and they knew who we were. And they kept saying, you know, we take our time with young brands because, you know, when we do place an order, you've got to be ready to fulfill it.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's a scary part.
And I was like, I'm ready. Of course I'm ready.
Yeah.
And it was just little by little, you know, after a year and a half of that, Matches took a chance on me. And, you know, it's a year and a half of feeling like an idiot because you're, you're emailing the same people and you're seeing them out and about and you're sort of saying, you know, hey, like, let me know if you ever want it. And
remember me.
And, you know, I think it's a bit of perseverance and a bit of luck. And I think it was the right product at the right time. And when I first started, there was nothing else like it. So people didn't want it because it was scary. It wasn't perfect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many people said.
Right. Versus all the brilliantly, perfectly shaped, polished pieces that you might normally see.
You know, so many people said to me in the beginning, like, oh, I'm not sure, like, it's a bit rough around the edges. I'm not sure that people will buy into that. Someone once said to me, which I'll never forget, like, you know, it's not very chic to wear three necklaces. You should just wear one necklace. And our whole thing was like layering medallions. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, once one person takes it, then, you know, the fashion industry can be fickle like that. Like,
sure.
It takes one person to believe in it, for then other people to be like, oh my gosh, I actually, now I really like it as well.
Oh, the good and the bad about the fashion industry.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of like biggest lesson learned the hard way, or, you know, a few maybe from those first years getting it off the ground, especially whether it's in the actual creation process, in manufacturing, in the business side? Because that's a lot to manage.
There have been so many lessons. You know, in retrospect, we've got a team of 25 now. And I think that it was such a personal brand to me that it took me a long time to let other people in. And I look back now and actually I think I wish I'd done that sooner, because I probably wouldn't have worked myself to the bone to the point of like nervous breakdown.
Yeah, makes sense.
I would have had, you know, more people to lean on. But then, you know, I don't think you can regret. I think it is what it is. And it was almost growing so fast that there wasn't even time to hire people, because that's, you know, a process in itself. To, you know, bring people in, to teach people, to train. And
sure.
I mean, yeah, there have been so many lessons. I wouldn't know where to start, honestly.
How big was your collection when you first got accepted to Matches? And where were you at that stage?
The collection that I pitched to Matches, there were probably around 50 pieces at that point. And I'll never forget, they placed an order for 47 units. It was the biggest order I'd ever had. I was like, oh, this is amazing. And it sold out in 4 weeks, and then they placed for 450 units.
Wow.
And I remember
at that point when they say 450, are you at all stressed out? Like, wait a minute, can I actually produce that?
Or I'm just so excited at that point. I remember I was in Peru on a train and I got the email for the reorder, and you know, you get to the bottom, you open the PDF and you're like, what?
Yeah.
And you're just excited at that point. You just know there's always a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
I don't think you can feel afraid of it.
How are you making things at that point? Because as you say, you did this one day course that you didn't love that much. Then you figured it out yourself. But I presume as you make more and more pieces, technically it gets a little more complicated, you know, a ring versus a necklace versus an earring. How did you figure all that out along the way? How to actually create what you were dreaming to create?
So I'd always make the initial piece in the wax. I get it cast, see what I like, and then the pieces that resonate with me. And once it's cast, you make a mold of that, which means you can replicate it.
Sure.
And our casters, you know, work closely with us. So they create the molds and do the casting. And then we're still, you know, around the corner from them in Hatton Garden. And I would collect it and assemble it in my bedroom, like buy the raw materials, buy the chains and the jump rings and assemble. So it was just, you know, you just need the time to do it. Obviously now the collections are, you know, a bit more complex and we've introduced new materials. So there are added, you know, dimensions to that. But in the beginning, I was just assembling everything myself. And that was, you know, time consuming, but quite matter of fact in many ways. Like, you know what the process is. So you do it. It's the hardest thing when you can't find the materials. So you make something. You know, I remember making this black onyx ring in the first collection and loved it. Loads of people were into it. And then I couldn't source any more of that black onyx. And then that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
And you have to like get resourceful. And that still happens today. You know, I think that's like a normal part of production.
Yeah. As you've grown both on the creative side, like you're saying, integrating new materials, I imagine new sort of tactics of creation. And on the business side, what are some of the things that you think have helped you to grow with it, to create new things or to, you know, this is a big question, so you can obviously, like anything, answer it however you wish. But how do you know how to grow that business along the way? What are some of the things that helped guide you? Did you have any kind of mentors maybe that you found a way, or, you know, things that you went to figure out what the next step is?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the creativity, I always found that, you know, I never wanted to look at anything contemporary. I didn't want to compare to what was out there. I just loved archaeology and history. And for me, I found my main inspiration from traveling. I used to travel a lot on my own, which I loved, with my analog camera, and go to markets and just people watch. And that was my source of inspiration. And I've actually missed that so much over the last year, obviously, with the pandemic. Oh, but that was, you know, my main source of inspiration. And I think gut was everything on that, and instinct, and, you know, not questioning yourself, just going with it.
That's a big one.
Yeah, that was, you know, a big thing. And then I was lucky on the business side. Once it started to grow, everyone that I worked with was just really generous with their time and their advice. And anyone I'd meet, you know, whether it was Natalie Kingham, who was fashion director at Matches, you know, would take time to have a coffee with me and give me some advice. And I think it was just asking, you know, it's quite lovely and amazing to see that, you know, when you ask for people's time, they're super happy to give it to you and they want to come on the journey with you. And yeah. So I was really lucky. I felt like I'd built a community of people to draw on.
That's good advice that I think is also really true in terms of just asking, and that people are often very happy to offer their advice if you ask the right way. And and if you're persistent in a gentle way, gentle persistence, versus kind of thinking that everything is impenetrable and you have to figure it out all yourself, because that can be pretty overwhelming.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of advice now at the point where you're at on your journey that you would give out to people starting out in really any creative industry, I guess?
Just do it. Do the things that you love. Don't question yourself. And actually, I think that goes when you start the business to, you know, when you grow it. And actually, you know, one of the challenges of growing it is that you've got more people around you. You've got more opinions. You've got
more people questioning.
More pressures, more opportunities, more people pitching in their ideas, which is amazing. But it can also be easy to lose yourself in that as well. And going back always to, you know, why did you start it? What do you love about it? What makes it you? And just focusing on that inner clarity.
As you've grown, have you experienced the pressure of, you know, fashion as an umbrella term is a really obviously fast-paced, very competitive, often oversaturated sort of space. Mm. Have you found yourself feeling the pressure of being compared to other brands or comparing yourself, or whether it's in creation or in growth?
Absolutely.
How do you kind of tune that out and do your own thing?
I think, you know, it's really poignant, and I'll be super honest about that. Like, it's not easy to tune it out, especially with, you know, the digital age we live in. Sure. You decide not to even follow anything, but it can find you because Siri's always listening.
Siri, Alexa, like, or someone's always there.
Yeah, I think, you know, I find that I was having an amazing conversation with someone who's a yoga teacher, and she works in the fashion industry, actually, earlier this week. And she was saying, you know, we are, as women, cyclical beings, and we will have those moments probably once every cycle that you feel lost and you compare yourself and you don't feel good enough and the pressure gets too much. But it's part of the process. You just have to kind of ride it through and just embrace that instead of trying to suppress it. Because, yeah, I think everyone feels it. And I certainly feel it. You know, as you say, there are lots of brands out there and lots of people doing amazing things. And it's a lot of pressure to keep up. But I think you go through that feeling, you let it overwhelm you. You cry, and then you wake up the next day and you just refocus. It's the kind of the challenge of life in general, isn't it?
Sure. And that's great. I think not just to ride the waves, obviously, ebbs and flows that we all have. And I think you're right, for women, that's interesting, the cyclical perspective, but not to be scared by those moments like, oh God, now things aren't working, because you find yourself in that space, because it is natural to be in that space. And it doesn't mean you stay in there as long as you see it for what it is.
Exactly. And the pressure actually is like, the demand to be creative at every moment of the year or of the day or of the month. And actually, that's not how creativity works. Like, that's not how inspiration works, and you can't force it. And again, like going back to that conversation, you know, everything is so linear, like, okay, next collection, next thing. You don't give yourself the time to breathe. And I think if you're not careful, that can engulf you. And then you start creating things that you don't actually believe in.
Right.
And you lose the integrity of what you're doing. So
that aren't you.
Yeah. I think like being able just to step back, I think time and like quiet moments in your head and drawing boundaries of saying like, actually, I need this time in order to do me and like go into my own head, into my universe, so that I can create the next thing. And yeah, just kind of drawing your own creative boundaries, your own boundaries in general of, you know, what you can do and what you can't.
I think that's very true. Also, everything you're saying, not just about the creative process, but also on a more bigger picture scale in terms of kind of figuring out where you're at or what you want to do in life. Because I really believe that's also not linear, you know, and that's often what we... What we hear is like you start at this job and then you move up and then you advance as if it's like this clear step up, up, up. And it's really not. And there's so much back and forth along the way. And if you don't stop to think about it, you can also end up doing something that's not you, not just creating something that's not new, you know?
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I mean, I think also a big thing as women is we are taught to be people pleasers in so many ways. I don't know if that resonates with you, but you know, we feel like we have to say yes to every opportunity, yes to everything, and never let anyone down. And actually, I think that maybe that's part of the issue, that we need to just kind of step back and it's okay to say no.
Yes.
And that's something that I fight against quite often.
Do you feel like you're better at saying no today than you used to be?
Depends on the day.
Depends on the cycle. Yeah. Well, it's the process.
Yeah.
So I know you have a lot to do. So before I let you go, just a couple quick questions. Sure. First of all, congrats. 2020, right in the middle of this global mess, you received the Queen Elizabeth Award for British Design.
Thank you.
What was that moment for you?
I was not expecting that at all. And it was super overwhelming. And I just felt really grateful. And the prize was for design and also for local manufacturing. So a big part of that, you know, I dedicate to my casters, George and Leo, this, you know, Cypriot family who have been in Hatton Garden since 1964. And they came to the ceremony after the show. And it was a really proud moment of just gratitude. Like for me, that was a moment of just like a thank you to every single person who's lifted me along the way and like been there for me along the way.
That's actually, I want to add one quick thing there that we didn't talk about, which is locally sourced and you're making everything in London, which is super rare these days more and more, because obviously it's always easier, well, not easier necessarily, but it's definitely cheaper to make things abroad.
Absolutely.
How did you end up making that decision? I mean, were you ever tempted, especially in terms of costs and setting your own prices? And as we said, you deal not just with the creative, but also with the business.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you have a bottom line to deal with. So what was that decision making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, any finance person would come in and tell you that the best way to increase your margin is to take production overseas. But I've always been really clear that, you know, the integrity of the brand is local manufacturing, the quality of our product, the transparency of where it's coming from. And, you know, they're my family, these casters, and it's an extension of us. So it's not growth at any cost for me, which is why, you know, we've not taken on any external investment. We've still achieved, you know, triple digit growth, but we want to do it our way because I've not created this brand to flip it and sell it and move on to the next thing. I want to be here in 20 years. I want it to be this, you know, heritage brand that means something. So it's the long game.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just feels right to keep it here.
And that's tough, I'm sure, to resist that temptation. And it's wonderful to have such a strong core and to bring yourself back to it, to remember why you're here, when I imagine you could have all kinds of business people around saying, you should do this, you should do that. This isn't the smartest way, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So my final questions, you've kind of answered it, I think, in many ways throughout our conversation. But I always like to ask it because I think it's interesting to catch people in some place on their road and have them look back. So if you were to sit down for coffee with 17, 18, 19 year old Roche, you can choose which one, which version, pre or post Oxford. But with everything that you've been through and learned so far, what do you think you might want to tell her?
Oh, wow. Just like, it's going to be okay. Everything will be okay. Like, don't sweat the small stuff. Let things go. Let things go faster.
Yeah.
I think actually maybe the one thing I wish I could have known sooner is that rejection is nothing to do with you. That was like a big thing for me all through my childhood and, you know, my 20s, and I'm still learning, you know.
Yeah.
If somebody doesn't want you, or if an opportunity doesn't come to fruition, it doesn't mean you're a failure or you're useless or you're not good enough. It's just, it's arbitrary, and it's about the other person, or, you know, not the right fit or not the right moment for a particular opportunity. Yeah, don't take it so personally.
And rejection can be excellent redirection that you just don't realize at the time, and actually puts you in a much better place. But
yeah,
everything will be okay is like the most simple and the most complex thing to figure out. I know I do. I think we all spend a lot of time in that space of concern, and it's just time wasted, and easier said than done, but it's still a really important one.
Yeah, I think it's worth, you know, taking a step back. And also, you know, time is precious. Like the time with your family is really precious. Yeah.
Something we've all learned, I think, even more in this last year.
Absolutely. I think, you know, that's one thing that I feel it on a very emotional level in a way that, you know, I definitely didn't as a teenager or even in my early 20s. But, you know, I feel a deep respect for my parents and I'm very aware of how finite time is and how health is a luxury and a privilege. And yeah, just love the people around you. It sounds so kind of cheesy, but, you know.
So true. I think a lot of other people have had the same experience over the last few years, but especially over the last year. And it's good to reorganize priorities in that way and to try to take something good out of it and to remember, okay, like most of the stuff is small stuff. Mm. And apropos your mom, I hope that now, although she was concerned about you taking the hard route, I feel like maybe you've shown that actually good decision, good route to take.
Yeah. It's very funny. Last weekend with my boyfriend, I had family dinner and she just burst out laughing. And I was like, why are you laughing? And she was like, well, it just cracks me up that like you were just in that room, like making some wax stuff, like making a mess in my house. And now you've got like 25 people and like an office and like everyone's got a computer. And she just could not stop laughing. And I was like, I'm glad that our growth is such a point of humor for you.
Yeah, I can imagine her like out the corner of the door, like peeking in when you're in the dark in front of fire, like shaping wax, and she's like, oh my god, where is this going?
Using her cutlery as well.
Well, I'm sure you can buy her very nice cutlery now to replace it. That's fine. Well, Rosh Matania, we'll let you get to your new studio and creating the next thing. I'm so excited to see also what's next. I follow your brand closely. So thank you so much for taking this time.
Thank you so much, Nira. It's been super nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, and send us your thoughts, any questions you want answered, or women you want to hear from on Twitter at Nareeb Ben or Instagram at Life Deconstructed Pod. Coming up next week, Shama Mishtali was born and raised in Casablanca, Morocco, to Arab Muslim parents. But as a teenager, she discovered her dad's family secret hidden even from her mom, his Jewish roots. In a raw, open conversation, she talks about everything from being censored in her own country to creating a jewelry line and her secret to having tough, uncomfortable, and perspective-changing conversations.
I had gotten all of the approvals lined up from the government, and then on the day of, I receive a call from the Ministry of Interior Affairs, and they say, there is no way we're going to let you have your exhibition. And I'm like, the works are already on the walls. I was on my way to a radio show. I walk into the space and they say, how come you've never done a solo exhibition in Morocco when you've had so many in the US and in Europe? And I said, well, because every time I try, there's someone who tries to censor me. And this was live. And the journalist was like, oh my God, what did she just drop?
Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Talia Golihov. I'm Nareeb Ben. We'll see you next week on Life Deconstructed.